And good morning once again, and welcome to another episode in The Other Side of Midnight. That time between dusk and dawn where the things that a lot of people kind of dismiss in daylight take on a totally new light at night. And that's going to be the story for this morning, because have we got a show for you. This is kind of like a kind of a dream show. I've had a lot of requests from email and some of the listeners who call in during nights of open hailing frequencies, that we do a show on the physics, that we actually get down to cases, and we talk about the hyperdimensional torsion field model, and we explain terms, and we kind of get into how it's going to totally transform the human condition and civilization, and will lead to all kinds of extraordinary possibilities that only now are seen in the pages of science fiction. Well, tonight's guest, an old friend of mine, Andrew Mount, was the executive assistant for Dr. Bruce De Palma, who unfortunately is no longer with us. But Bruce and I became friends and colleagues many, many years ago, probably more than 20 years now. And it was so remarkable that he turned out to be doing the experiments going back to the 70s and even before, that our theoretical work in terms of the HD torsion field model predicted had to exist. And one of the most important of these is having to do with the whole concept of inertia. So without further ado, let me basically say, to context this program, it's in connection with the programs we've done over the last couple of nights regarding what we're now seeing in the data from Cydonia. Because, of course, the stunning image from MRO, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, focusing on this huge pyramid, the DNM pyramid, it was the mathematics in the DNM pyramid, a la my friend and colleague at the Defense Mapping Agency, Errol Torin, that basically allowed Errol and me to crack the Cydonia code to the physics that years later Bruce De Palma would be confirming in his laboratory experiments going back to when he was at MIT and thereafter. So there is a context, a larger context to tonight. And without further ado, let me introduce Andrew. Andrew has about a 25-year background in this whole system solution, environmental science, and new paradigm physics. He has spent the last 6 years practicing permaculture and developing food security initiatives in the Rogue Valley of Southern Oregon, his, I love this phrase, pastoral home. We're going to have Andrew describe his pastoral home when we bring him on here. Andrew's social entrepreneurship efforts have been recognized by folks like Dr. Muhammad Yunus, who was the Nobel laureate, at the 2003 Oregon Social Business Challenge. Andrew served as key organizer in the successful campaign to ban GMOs in Jackson County, Oregon. After his 9-year tenure as secretary to Bruce De Palma and as trustee of the De Palma Institute, Andrew co-founded the New Energy Movement.org, NEM, with the late Dr. Brian O'Leary and others, serving as an associate director and advisor to the NEM's board. He is co-founder of the Southern Oregon Slow Money and an organic farmer. This development of advanced energy and propulsion systems remain an enduring passion, yet Andrew also believes that biomass revolutions on the horizon to reforest and regreen the earth is needed even more urgently than a second industrial revolution. I think we're going to have an interesting discussion tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to The Other Side of Midnight and my friend Andrew Mount. Andrew, good morning.
Good morning. It's a great honor, Richard. Thank you for calling me today, and I'm grateful to be here.
Well, the hyperdimensional resonances seem to say this was the time to move from the theoretical to what does it mean if you discover an incredible Type 2 civilization in your backyard? How can we actually turn this knowledge, this expanding database, into something that's practical? And then I thought of Bruce De Palma, our friend who's no longer here, and it just seemed to me appropriate to bring you on stage and to kind of discuss this evening how you got together with De Palma in the first place, because you guys went back decades.
I met Bruce in Santa Barbara, where he was something of a fixture starting around 1979. I met him in 1988. But Bruce had gained a reputation as being a maverick of science, you know, way back in during his days in well, immediately post MIT, and that would have been in the early 70s. But what Bruce basically had done was decide that the questions that were being asked him by his students, very fundamental questions, for which he had no answers, were the signal that he really needed to look directly at the logic and reasoning processes behind the physics of the day.
And we're talking mainly mechanical physics, right?
It was the studies on rotation which fascinated Bruce primarily, because, you know, there are equations that science would have you believe are the full and complete explanation for the complex motions found in rotating bodies, but Bruce didn't buy that. The Euler's equations specifically. It just struck Bruce that there were a number of behaviors of gyroscopes in particular that he thought were puzzling. And I mean, everybody has been fascinated by why a gyroscope almost seems to be alive and have its own, you know, self-referential field of force that, you know, won't allow you to manipulate it beyond a certain point, because it will always strive to correct itself. So I guess basic experimental science, which was Bruce's discipline, relies on a certain amount of curiosity and wonder and belief that science hasn't got all the answers. I mean, why would you try a new experiment if you had read all the theories and they told you nothing more was possible?
Which there actually was a guy in the 19th century who apparently was head of the patent office who actually made that insane statement in writing, that right. Basically everything had been discovered and there were just a few decimal places left to fill in. And I guess he issued his formal resignation with that letter.
I seem to remember that story, yes.
Well, Bruce was such a revolutionary, even at MIT. I mean, I know he got in trouble with people like Wheeler over at Princeton and Edward Land, who he worked for at Polaroid, kind of part-time while he was also still teaching at MIT, because he questioned everything. And then when he got into these experiments, I mean, you've got to describe this amazing experiment, which is the foundation for a whole new appreciation of physics, because it was something as simple as take two steel pinballs, spin one up to something like 27,000 RPM, have the other one stationary, put them in a mechanical gadget. He was very good at designing mechanical gadgets for experiments.
Yes.
Fire them up into the air at an angle. Take stroboscopic pictures of them. In fact, if you go to othersideofmidnight.com, which is our website, and then you click on the upper right-hand corner, Radio with Pictures, that takes you to the guest page tonight. Number 10, image number 10. Click on number 10. And, Andrew, describe what we're seeing.
Okay. Well, it was indeed something of a homemade experiment, and therefore arguably not, you know, an utterly flawless design, experimental design. But what he discovered through stroboscopic photography is that when you launch a rotating versus a non-rotating object simultaneously, you'll discover some very interesting things. The rotating...
This is under Earth's gravity field, right?
Under Earth's gravity, yeah. And it's not in a vacuum, which is, I suppose, one of the weaknesses of the experimental design. But what you discover is something very interesting. The rotating object, okay, you can actually measure that it goes up more slowly than the non-rotating object. the distance between the flashes, you know, the images of each ball on the path of its trajectory demonstrates that the rotating object climbs more slowly.
Against gravity.
Against gravity. And travels further, falls faster, and hits harder.
And every Newtonian physicist seeing this goes, ah, runs out of the room screaming.
Well, I was reading today even online some people who are, I guess, armchair physicists who tried to explain it away due to simple aerodynamic forces. But that does not explain why it climbs more slowly, falls further, and hits harder. And this experiment was repeated countless times, including in the office of John Archibald Wheeler.
Now, and, you might tell folks, because remember, we have a millennial audience who may never have heard of John Wheeler. John Wheeler, wait for it, is the guy who coined the famous term.
Goodness gracious, which one?
The one associated with John Wheeler, black holes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, he was the foremost expert on gravity and co-developer of the hydrogen bomb with William Teller.
Mm-hmm.
I know that much.
You mean Edward Teller?
Sorry, Edward Teller. I apologize. I was thinking of William Tell, I guess. It's a little little late in the evening. But
well, we are talking about spinning things, spinning apples, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, when you look at the graph, you know, for all the naysayers, the subtle forces, the things that would mess up this conclusion, are so far below the level of the signal here. We're not looking at slightly marginal differences. We're looking at huge differences. And so any noise due to, you know, vorticity in the atmosphere or irregularity in the spring mechanism and all that just can't explain the overwhelming signal to noise ratio between the non-spinning and the spinning object.
Well, and actually that's why this particular visual image is so powerful. At first glance, it's powerful, but even looking more deeply into, you know, the features of the experiment that I described specifically with reference to the slow climb of the of the rotating object.
And again, for people who might have missed it, it's image number 10, Radio with Pictures, othersideofmidnight.com, Radio with Pictures takes you to image number 10. Mm-hmm. That's this is an actual photographic copy of the original data that Bruce took, what, back in 1974, 75?
I do believe it was mid-70s. And what this led to was a series of additional experiments, including the construction of totally novel machines known as the Force Machine.
Which link are we looking at now?
I will tell you that would be image number 13.
Okay.
This is a hand-drawn copy, and it's somewhat smaller than the original, and I could try to get you guys a clearer copy later. But the point is, two counter-rotating gyroscopes were mounted in their own independently rotating cylinder.
So we're looking at a box from the side.
Well, it's not a box. It's a cylinder.
Okay.
The outer frame is a box that is housing a rotating cylinder inside of which are mounted two counter-rotating gyroscopes with their motors so that the entire assembly may be rotated, mm-hmm. which created a rotating object free of the forces of gyroscopic motion because the gyroscopic forces are canceled within the machine.
So they're rotating in opposite directions?
Correct.
Okay. And we're looking at them edge-on.
Yes.
But that cylinder inside where they're sticking straight up and down can rotate into the plane of the image or out of the plane.
At 90 degrees to the plane of rotation okay. of the gyroscopes.
Okay. And what happens when he did that?
Well, you achieve a condition known as forced precession because you know a gyroscope will ordinarily want to express a second order of rotation known as precession. Just that's the wobble that you see when you stand a gyroscope up, an energized gyroscope up on a table. Mm. That's called precession. That's the second order of rotation. Now, Bruce found a way to accentuate this effect through forced precession. And there were some very odd effects, such as changing the period of the pendulum. If you made such an object into the bob of a pendulum, okay, there would be a change in the period of that pendulum.
So wait. We take this cylinder,
the entire machine,
with the entire machine, frame. and we put a wire on it, and we extend it up to the ceiling, 30, 40, 50 feet.
Correct.
And we make this machine the bob of that huge pendulum.
That's right.
And then you swing it back and forth with nothing turned on. And then you swing it back and forth with the gyroscope spinning inside the little box, well, big box.
Yeah.
And what's the difference?
Well, you can do several different experiments. You can do experiments where you swing the pendulum with the gyroscopes energized and not rotating the outer cylinder.
Mm-hmm.
You can position them so that the pendulum moves within the plane of rotation versus along the axis of rotation. You can see that,
mm-hmm.
depending on which way you orient the axles of the gyroscopes. But then, of course, you can also do the forced precession on top of that, and you can collide this object with other objects of the same construction. In fact, he made exact duplicates of this so that he could do what's called the elastic collision of a rotating and non-rotating object. So Bruce was a very thoroughgoing, experimentalist, and he discovered, I would say, about five different ways you could test this machine, including putting one next to another and seeing if there were any field effects. And indeed, they filmed this on early home TV camera. That the object of one, the emotions of one object will be translated to an adjacent object through some sort of field effect, just by what he called the dragging of inertial frames.
So wait. He has like two of these in a room, and they're
correct.
Suspended from the ceiling. One of them is turned on and is moving like
yep.
a pendulum.
Uh-huh.
The other one is just sitting there.
Right.
And the field effect, the inertial, spatial, torsion field, whatever etheric connection between the box that's moving like a pendulum and the one that's just sitting on its wire from the ceiling.
Yep.
The effect transmits from the one that's moving to the one that's not moving.
Correct. So.
And how do we know that wasn't air currents and stuff like that?
You know, I surely wish that Bruce or his assistant Ed Delvers were still with us and could tell you how they guarded against any such effects. But that's only one element of the overall experimental
work.
Well,
one obvious way is to put a barrier like plexiglass or something between the
right.
two pendulums so that you can't have air effects. But besides the forces, you want to talk about the magnitude of the forces that these things would generate when you spun them up?
Well, yes. Indeed, tool steel axles were snapped. So that's how strong the forces were.
So we're talking thousands of pounds per square inch or something like that.
Yes, I'm not a mechanical engineer, but I can tell you that there are ways to improve this design that Bruce never got around to implementing that would constrain the forces within the machine even more potently. And that's actually the significance of a force machine in terms of the history of mechanical design. This is the first machine that applies its forces against space as opposed to something like a screw, a lever, an inclined plane, a spring. All these are fundamental machines. They apply their force to a load, to an external load, whereas this machine is designed specifically to concentrate as much force as possible in one space. And the result is a changing of the physics properties of that object And apparently other objects immersed within the field effect. Now, there are some other images I could have sent you regarding experiments which you can find on Bruce's website that prove the existence of this field effect.
Okay, why don't you go up to the links and tell people where the actual links to Bruce's experiments are, because obviously after every show, people, they linger, they look, they click, they explore,
okay, link,
which
link
is what they should do.
Link number 5 in the list of links on the guest page is free energy. Oops, sorry, I don't think this is correct. It's actually link number 7, the home of primordial energy.
Okay.
This is Bruce's official website that we designed back in New Zealand right at the inception of the internet age. I think it must have been 1996 or something.
That's when we set up Enterprise.
When we built this.
The dawn of the internet.
But at any rate, there are a number of papers on this website, depalma.pair.com. One of the papers in here is about the test. I think it's going to be on The Secret of the Force Machine, which basically shows that some of his earliest experiments.
That's the fifth link down on Bruce's page.
Actually, I'm afraid that's not the correct page.
It says The Secret of the Force Machine. Let me click on it and see what
it says. Yeah, but I'm just trying to find the correct
one. There it
is.
It says Secret of the Force Machine.
Right, but there's another test where he demonstrated that it may not even be on his website, but he demonstrated that a crystal oscillator, a radio frequency oscillator, was affected by the presence of a rotating mass, and that a tuning fork actuated watch made by the Bulova watch company, known as the Accutron watch, was also similarly influenced by the inertial anisotropy, to use a very fancy physics term, that Bruce posited to exist around a rotating mass. Namely, what he called variable inertia.
Okay, let me stop you there, because that's, of course, what you're describing is the basic experiment that Bruce did, again, in the mid-70s, which was the progenitor of our Accutron torsion field detection technology. Why don't you describe what Bruce did in the lab with the Accutron, 30 years ago or more?
Yes, well, one of the flywheels that we see inside the Force Machine, which I believe was about a 30-pound aluminum flywheel, was placed in proximity to the Accutron watch. And in fact, I believe the Accutron itself was pasted or mounted on the face of an electrically actuated clock. And so they were able to do side-by-side, deviation measurements over time. They'd energize the flywheel, but first synchronize the two clock faces.
So the West clock and the Accutron were set to read exactly the same time. The Accutron is on battery power. It's got a little tuning fork. Tuning fork
right.
Goes back and forth, is how you measure time in the Accutron. The West clock has its control synchronous motor synchronized with the grid.
Correct.
Which is good old Tesla 60 cycle alternating current coming from the wall.
Correct. There is an experimental paper on this somewhere on his website. I have to remind myself of where it is, but it's an appendix to another paper, I think, and I'll find it before the night is through here. But the point is that aside from the experiments on the collision of the rotating and non-rotating object and the pendulum experiments, there were also a number of other experiments done, such as the Accutron experiment, where there was over time a deviation in the reading on the Accutron versus the reading on the electric clock. And the only variable was this, you know, rotating mass in the vicinity. Mm. He also grew.
Do you happen to remember the numbers on that? Because I do. He ran it for 17 minutes, and I always said to myself, why was it 17 minutes? Well, it turns out that 17 minutes is 1,000 seconds. So you want a nice even number to do the math. And the deviation, the Accutron, lost 1 whole second of time for a watch that the bull of a company was touting as accurate to a second per month. In 17 minutes, which is 1,000 seconds, it lost a full second compared to the West clock plugged into the wall, which had its synchronous motor synchronized with the entire electrical grid.
Yep.
And that's, of course, impossible.
Yep.
I mean, the stunning thing about Bruce De Palma is he was the first guy I found that actually did replicable laboratory experiments demonstrating that inertia, the supposedly incredible immutable force that governs everything in our lives, from machines to rockets to airplanes to cars to anything mechanical, inertia, ultimately, if you fall in an elevator, inertia is what kills you, you know, the final step of the bottom. Bruce found that inertia can be changed. It can be varied. It can be like potted up and down. I mean, this is a stunning, stunning revolution could get almost nobody to pay attention to.
The thing he discovered,
Wheeler
actually
threw him out of his office.
The thing that he discovered actually was that the variation in inertia is dependent upon the motion, the orientation of the motion. In other words, motions along the axis of rotation had a higher inertial reading, and motions along the plane of rotation, going back to the force machine experiments, had a lower inertial condition. Hmm. This variation is actually a polarization.
Of course.
And not a mere anisotropy, but an actual polarization of the inertial forces. So,
in other words, the forces are not spherical. They have geometry.
Yeah, you could say it actually becomes toroidal to a certain extent.
Mm, hold it there. My guest this morning is Andrew Mount, executive assistant and secretary to the late Dr. Bruce De Palma. Bruce left us with a stunning legacy, empirical experiments that, in fact, inertia, the cornerstone of Newtonian mechanics, thought to be immutable, except under extraordinary conditions like nuclear fission or fusion. No, it can be changed at room temperature in a laboratory if you spin masses high enough and you process them fast enough, strange, exotic, non-Newtonian forces emerge. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. This is Clive Wright's Gravity. In the background, we shall return. We are back on the other side of midnight, and in answer to Andrew's question, yes, not only is the show archived, but it's archived in a very special place called Club 19.5, which is the numerical demarcation of the physics that Bruce De Palma spent decades empirically confirming are really, really not Newtonian and exhibit all kinds of incredibly anomalous properties, which the world has been rejecting up until relatively recent. There are some activities going on at NASA that appear now from a totally different perspective to be in the process of ultimately confirming many of the experiments that Dr. De Palma conducted many decades ago. So, Andrew, please continue.
Well, I found that paper. It's in the It's in the paper known as On the Nature of Electrical Induction at depalma.pair.com.
Okay.
On the Nature of Electrical Induction, the appendix at the bottom is the real mechanical test for the inertial field. Let's see what the proper title is. It's called Simple Experimental Test for the Inertial Field of a Rotating Real Mechanical Object. The notion that inertia is variable runs in stark contrast to the assumption that even Einstein made of an equivalence between gravity and inertia. And that's pretty much why, in some ways, Bruce is probably the unsung hero of modern day physics, because he's showing that that was a gross assumption for anyone to have made, just because there was no experiment to determine a difference between inertia and gravity. But this seems to be the smoking gun, so to speak, that does away with the notion of equivalence of inertia and gravitation. It also puts us in a situation where we might be able to bias this inertial polarization to achieve unidirectional thrust without the need of an expulsion, you know, mass or reaction mass. So it heralds the end of rocketry, which is really the only way we're going to ever have a true space age. And think of what that would do for transportation on Earth if we all had, you know, anti-gravity hovercrafts at the very least. huge masses could be lifted in, you know, whatever application. I strongly believe, just to let you know my orientation, that technology development of this sort, which is truly, you know, a quantum leap, will have to be done in an environmentally ethical way. In other words, if suddenly we're going to unlock the secrets of hyperdimensional physics and have more energy at our disposal as a culture than we ever have, what's going to restrain us from mining all of the minerals on the sea floor and, you know, taking out the very last little bit of, you know, shale oil and gas that we can through whatever extractive means, now that we have all this power at our disposal?
Well, wait. There are two sides to the coin. Bruce didn't live long enough to see other experiments that clearly demonstrate that not only when you tweak the ether, when you tickle the torsion field, when you do things either mechanically or electronically that resonate with this matrix in which all of 3D reality is embedded, you not only can create forces that allow you to negate gravity and inertia, but you also can create matter. The idea of mining something on the surface of a planet is so 19th century. It's so Stephen Hawking in warning us against aliens that come to strip mine our you know, solar system. Because a real Type 2 civilization, a la the kind of civilization that built the things we're seeing on Mars now, we've been talking over the last several days, it doesn't mine stuff.
Right.
It makes it out of nothing in space. And then it, you know, moves it from where it makes it to where it needs it. And in some variations of that process, it beams it from one location to another, a la my friend Gene Roddenberry and the transporter. So we're not talking about strip mining the world using this kind of technology. That is so primitive compared to how you would really use it.
Well, that's actually how I used to think when I was immersed in this on a daily basis. And you remind me how quickly I can fall into that limited mindset that, you know, most people are in when they don't realize that the laws of thermodynamics are not absolute. And that's basically what Bruce and the other dissident scientists in his field were.
Talk about Eric Lathwaite. I mean, this British guy I've fallen in love with. Again, he's another folk that's not with us. But talk about Lathwaite and what Lathwaite did independent of Bruce, that totally confirmed the weird, extraordinary things that Bruce was finding, and nobody would listen to him.
Well, the funny thing is, like Bruce, Lathwaite was an establishment figure. Up until the time that Bruce started espousing anti-gravity and, you know, and the possibility of free energy, he was up there with the best of them. He was working as Dr. Harold Edgerton's assistant, et cetera. You know, Eric Lathwaite was the inventor of the linear electric motor, which is used in maglev trains, and had his own BBC science program. He was like the Bill Nye of the 1950s or something like that in the UK.
Yep.
And he then later in life began, like Bruce, to see the limitations, or shall we say the possibilities, that were being ignored by science. And it largely had to do with the forced precession of gyroscopes. He realized that if you could build the proper configuration of arms and wheels.
This is Lathwaite now in Britain.
Lathwaite, yeah. Towards the end of his life, he was trying to develop inertial propulsion. He was trying to develop, you know, the intrinsic potentialities of the gyroscope, because he, you know, anybody who spends enough time meditating on these objects realizes that they have mysteries bound up in them that need to be released, and if only we're ready to see them.
Well, you go back to image number 10, the spinning ball. It's so simple, so elementary, so elegant, so clear, that if you rotate something, it behaves in a gravity field radically different than it ever should have, according to Newtonian equations. And you can reproduce this anomaly till the cows come home, over and over and over.
Including in the simple dropping of a gyroscope in an enclosed box, which he and a number of his students did over and over again, and discovered various anomalies. Now, admittedly, since then, the Japanese and others have conducted experiments to show that there are variations in the behavior of gyroscopes depending on which way they're rotating or what have you. But I can simply say that Bruce was probably worthy of the distinction of the Galileo of our times, in that he was the one to drop the rotating and non-rotating object, as we discussed at the start of the show, side by side, and to demonstrate the unexpected behaviors. It just happened to be that he was an expert in stroboscopic photography, having worked with Harold Edgerton, the inventor of stroboscopic photography, which he applied directly to that experiment. And I don't think you can see as clearly without that photograph, number 10, what exactly is going on there, because of the elements of the experiment I mentioned earlier. But, you know, there's so many different things Bruce did, because he moved into the theoretical realm and decided, well, if a simple rotating object has heretofore unknown and certainly unexplained behaviors, what if I were to create a magnetized gyroscope that was rotated on its axis of magnetism? Would this not be a generator principle that might partake of similar anomalous
behavior? He was looking at a mechanical device that would take the anomalous forces in the gyroscopes and the spinning ball and all that, and he was trying to move sideways from mechanical forces to electrical forces to see if he could harness in one machine the apparent free energy that's showing up in mechanics into something that would be useful, like electricity.
Right. So what he effectively did was rediscover Michael Faraday's discovery on December 26, 1831, of what is now known as the homopolar generator or unipolar dynamo. He hadn't been taught very much, if at all, at MIT about the homopolar generator.
Really?
Largely because people don't understand
Well, you got to go back to square one. You have to describe the difference between standard electrical understanding of magnetic fields and wires and currents, and how the homopolar generator radically differs, and yet it produces the same result, which is impossible unless our theory is wrong.
I'm pretty practiced at that, so let me give it a shot.
Go for it.
Standard induction, discovered by Michael Faraday, the father of electrical science, relies on the passage of a conducting wire across the pole, whether north or south, it doesn't matter, of a magnet, okay? And then a potential difference, also known as a voltage, is generated across that wire when it cuts the flux lines, as modern theory would say.
But the wire, the circuit, has to be moving.
It has to be moving.
If it's or just the sitting, magnet. Or the magnet or, moving. Or the magnet. There has to be relative motion, because if they sit relatively motionless relative to each other, you don't get any voltage and no current.
Right. Whereas, at the same time, Michael Faraday discovered that if you co-rotate magnet and conductor on the same axis of magnetism, such that there's no relative motion between magnet and conductor, that you still get the effect.
Which is impossible, because it's like you got two opposites and they're supposedly canceling each other and they don't.
Well, some people will say, oh, yes, there's relative motion because you've got wires that are pulling that current off of there. But guess what? There's no change in flux. There may be relative motion of some kind, but you can't say between what and what unless you posit moving flux lines or stationary flux lines, both of which are constructs and not verifiable experimentally. You can't say that a flux line actually exists as a physical reality. It's just a construct.
So what did Bruce theoretically think was going on to make the homopolar generator work?
Well, this is where his skill as a theoretician is demonstrated. He believed that since he had already discovered an inertial anisotropy, effectively a distortion.
You have to describe anisotropy.
Well, anisotropy means something with very directional properties versus isotropic or isotropy, which means all properties in all directions.
So the one would be a spherical wave, like dropping, you know, pebbles in a pond. You get spherical little wavelets coming off. Mm-hmm. And the other would be highly geometric with, you know, huge areas where the energy was going out and areas right next to it where there is no energy at all. So it's very beamed.
He thought that if we were to superpose, which is a physics term, superposition, the inertial field effect upon the magnetic field at the same time, that there would be some unique result. And what?
So one would affect the other.
Yes, that they would become conjoined, merged in that system, and that therefore that you'd have a right to expect something. And
in other words, the rotating system energy would somehow be transferred electrically in a machine that was rotating, according to his specs, into an electrical current, a voltage coming out.
Well, right. I mean, the rotating magnetized conductor, which is the simplest way to refer to a homopolar generator, is a device that resembles a force machine, and that's why I think it appears in his paper on the secret of the force machine, because a Faraday disc, which is another term for this configuration, you know, it puzzles the mind of the theoretician, because if you believe that you need a change in flux in order to achieve induction, in order to generate electrons, you'll not find it in a rotating magnetized conductor, because conductor and magnet co-rotate. So people have been striving to understand this. There really is no explanation other than, I think, Bruce's very elegant explanation, which is to posit a pre-existing primordial energy field, which today is easily done because we talk about the quantum field. We talk about the innate potentialities.
Well, the 19th century talked about the ether. The Russians have talked about the torsion field. They're all the same thing.
Well, he wrote an actual paper called Magnetism as a Distortion of a Pre-Existent Primordial Energy Field and the Possibility of Extraction of Electrical Energy Directly from Space. Mm-hmm. A long title. But the point is this. If electrons are an inherently available resource that can be squeezed, if you will, out of the quantum field, how do you do that? Well, it's Bruce's belief that that's why a co-rotating magnet and conductor can actually precipitate energy. It's because through the superposition of the inertial field and the magnetic field in this particular configuration of a Faraday disk, you are actually precipitating electrons directly from space, but by virtue of the fact that space has to have some sort of counterpoise or reaction to all that distortion that you're creating. See, space is basically isotropic, but the minute you try to, shall we say, put a spanner in the works or a warp in the field, what is space going to do?
Well, now it's interesting because Maurice Allais, the name I'm sure you know, the French economist who did all the physics experiments and measured pendulums during eclipses and found extraordinarily anomalous non-inertial motions. Hmm. He measured, even without eclipses, that space is not isotropic. It's not the same in all directions. It has a geometry. Hmm. Because we're not in space that's unmodeled. It's space that's distorted by the presence of the Earth, by the Moon, by the Sun, our nearest star. So those distortions Allais was able to measure with his pendulums, and the distortions went nuts during an eclipse.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what we're basically talking about is the same thing, that we're living within some kind of sensitive medium. I guess that's what the ether would have been referred to as the way Bruce liked to look at it was as a sea of potentiality, of pure potentiality. Because of that, we have a right to expect that if you sort of insist upon space taking note of your experiment by making it extraordinarily anisotropic, meaning asymmetrical with respect to the largely isotropic nature of the space itself, then space is going to react. And the way that it reacts in this particular experiment is it produces electrons. Now, Bruce went so far as to say that wires don't actually carry electrons, but they merely carry the space distortion or the polarization of charges, positive and negative, masculine and feminine, however you want to look at it, until you recombine them at the load, and that's where the electrons appear, is at the load, not at the generating end, and that no electron has ever been verified to have traveled down a wire, one of Bruce's favorite things to say.
Oh, no wonder he was such a favorite of all the mainstream physicists around him.
Oh, exactly. Do you see what heresy that is?
Yes, of course. Well, Wheeler, again, I'll come back. He tried to show Wheeler, the big, mucho honcho of black holes, the guy who coined the term black holes, Mr. Gravity at Princeton. In his throne room, I'm sorry, his office.
Yes.
And when he demonstrated the spinning ball, I guess it was photographs and the graphs and all that, Wheeler essentially threw him out of his office. Didn't want to get within five light years of that experiment.
He didn't quite throw him out of the office, but Bruce had a way of being more than a little,
impolitic.
Impolitic relative to the conventional physics establishment. He walked into Wheeler's office and saw that every wall and every shelf was covered in books and papers, and he said, "Doctor, someday all of this may be reduced to one sin volume. Wheeler said to him, I'll have you removed.
So we did have him thrown out of the office.
And then things settled down, and they did the experiment. But the main reason Wheeler even entertained seeing Bruce De Palma was because of a newspaper article in the Trenton Times, which said, why won't John Wheeler have a visit from Bruce De Palma? Because Bruce had tried for years to get in to see him, and it was his students, I think, who spurred the paper on.
So Bruce politically wielded the power of the web, meaning citizen scientists, the vox populi, mm-hmm. on Wheeler in an era when the web didn't exist, and all you could do was letters to the editor, and he got enough letters in there to get a piece in the Sunday paper that shamed John Wheeler into having a meeting.
He was shamed into seeing Bruce. That's basically how that worked. But at any rate, I guess the real triumph that Bruce experienced in his later years when he was working with the rotating magnetized conductor, homopolar generator, unipolar dynamo, Faraday disc, is that numerous other researchers, namely Trombley and Tewari, plus a man named Shuji Inomata in Japan, all took this research up in their respective laboratories, two of which were government-funded labs.
Mm-hmm. The one in India.
One in India and one in Japan. And did fairly rigorous third-party testing on rotating magnetized gyroscopes. And indeed, there are various anomalies. W. Robert Kinchlow, a professor emeritus of electrical engineering from Stanford, also performed studies on Bruce's original N machine, which is what he dubbed this homopolar generator, and N standing for any number. You know, he believed there were any number of things that could come from this advance in physics understanding. That's why he called it the N machine. But at any rate...
But we also discussed the idea that N could stand for dimensions, where the energy ultimately was coming from.
N-dimensional is what it stands for, yes.
Yep.
But at any rate, there are some links on your website related to the Kinchlow report.
Yeah, that's number 6, the N machine test.
I'm going to click that myself. Just to be 100% sure. I'm actually not sure that that is an active link for some reason, but I'm having trouble clicking it on your...
Robert Kinchlow, N machine test.
Oh, it came up for you? Okay.
Yep, on some Rex research.
Yeah. At any rate, that stands as the definitive test of the potential behind this particular device. Strangely... Bruce's first example of an N machine performed better than any future models. And he discovered later it was because of some sort of almost unconscious design benefits that he had incorporated into the machine, having to do with cancellation of the magnetic field generated by the current. But at any rate, Tewari in India today is still developing machines which partially cancel, if not fully cancel, the electromagnetic effects. See, the whole thing is Lenz's law.
When you say electromagnetic, you mean the so-called back EMF, back electromotive force?
The Lenz's law, which basically says if you're going to cut these, you know, lines of force and generate lines of force yourself by extracting current, then you're going to get pushback. You're going to get electromechanical drag. And Tewari right now is taking some Lathwaite's discovery, so we can finish this discussion of Lathwaite. Lathwaite was also saying, look, there are novel ways to create your rotor and stator configuration within a normal induction machine, so that you do not expose the current carrying wires to the same amount of EMF. And that is actually what Tuareg is commercializing right now, is a novel induction machine, which he calls the reactionless AC generator. And, I mean, he claims that it, you know, produces energy with fewer losses than standard induction machines.
But does it go over unity?
Well, see, that's a term you've just introduced in this conversation. If indeed thermodynamics are not absolute, which basically, you know, thermodynamics insists that unity, 100%, is mm-hmm. the maximum efficiency that could ever be achieved in any, you know, electromechanical or other energetic system.
But yeah, that's only if the system is confined to three dimensions. If you open up n dimensions, if you give access to an ether transduction system that allows energy to be ported in from n space dimensions, mm-hmm. then you're no longer dealing with a closed system, so thermodynamics, as defined in three dimensions, is no longer relevant.
Right, as long as you accept that the universe is not a closed system. In fact, there was a physical chemist named Ilya Prigozhin who won the Nobel Prize for demonstrating that in certain chemical reactions, there are what are called autopoietic or self-organizing effects, which means energy is liberated and not consumed, i.e. negative entropy. So that's what overunity means. Overunity means negative entropy. Anything over 100% or 1-to-1 is overunity.
In our dimensions.
Hold
it there. We're at the top of the hour. I made a mistake last night and said we're at the bottom of the hour, and Scotty yells from the engine room, top, we're at the top of the hour. My guest this morning is Andrew Mount. We're discussing a dear departed friend of ours, Dr. Bruce De Palma, a mechanical genius, a theoretical explorer, a courageous guy, a real friend, and someone whose brother, decades later, actually chose a film called The Mission to Mars to immortalize Bruce's physics, his brother's physics, in some extraordinary, elegant ways, which we'll discuss when we return on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and this is Christopher Morford. Tell me, Mrs. Constance, can't hear you anymore. What's a father? Tell me, garden, with a weed's found this angry seed. Once were flowers in the garden, in their best days. And we are back on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning, Andrew Mount, and we're discussing the really fundamentally revolutionary physics of our friend, our late friend, Dr. Bruce De Palma. Because what Bruce did was he started out kind of reinventing the wheel, pun intended, looking at rotation. Remember, the cornerstone of hyperdimensional physics is rotation, rotation, rotation. Well, he examined in the lab all kinds of permutations of rotation and then connected the idea of the anomalous forces that he found in those experiments with the idea of the Faraday homopolar disk and anomalous forces found in a rotating magnetized system. I have a question, and maybe you'll know the answer, and maybe you won't, Andrew. Did he ever force process the end machine rotating disk?
You're a man after my own heart, because actually that is a device that could prove to be both an anti-gravity and free energy machine all in one. And there are images of that design on a couple of the papers on Bruce's site. I did not I did put one up here that looks – it's like about a half step towards that. If you look at image 15,
it has to be 15. Okay.
Yeah, but there's a step beyond that where that whole thing gets mounted inside its own cylinder that can rotate. And so you have two counter-rotating end machines that cancel their electromotive forces because their two conducting plates are right next to each other. One is producing negative, one is producing positive because they're counter-rotating.
Mm-hmm.
But then you jointly rotate all of those elements inside its own housing, just as you did in the simple force machine. And actually, I can say no one has done that. Hmm. So if we can find a generous benefactor out there who's willing to fund us to the tune of, you know, a couple of hundred thousand to build a really solid force machine that is electromotively charged.
So you think it would cost that much?
I would not want to build it for any less because I want to run it right up to destructive testing levels and see how much we can really pull out of this thing. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, we could probably do a much simpler, you know.
Yeah, I would think you could. I mean, this audience is actually funding the work of an inventor, a technologist, an engineer named Dave Distler, who is producing his own version, his garage version of the M drive, which is, you know, taken headlines by storm and has been tested by NASA and by the Chinese and a lot of do-it-yourselfers, engineers in their off hours. And Dave is really getting positive results. It wouldn't take much more than the few thousand dollars that we've raised for him to upgrade his experiments to create a mechanical system, because basically you're talking machining, you're talking precision machining. You're talking something which is massive enough so it doesn't break apart, you know, if you spin it up to a few hundred RPM. And you basically demonstrate proof of principle, and then you raise a lot more money to build one that basically can take you to the moon.
Well, the mass is key because these effects often are scaled at something like, you know, the square of the diameter or even – you know, cube of the mass or something like that. I'm not 100%.
Well, they go with the angular momentum of the machine. So you either have a small, low-mass machine spinning like a bat out of hell,
right,
which is the steel ball, 27,000 RPM.
Right.
You can spin steel balls at 27,000 RPM, and they don't fly apart, which is useful to know because you don't want your experiment coming apart in your face. Plexiglass glasses will not protect you if these things come apart. So you, again, do not do this at home without knowing what you're doing.
Right.
But the forces that come out of this, according to his own work back in the 70s, are on the order of thousands of pounds of fused to a few snowflake levels in the electromagnetic version, which is the so-called EM drive. Which actually, in terms of your description tonight, I think there might be an interesting crossover between these two ostensibly totally different technologies, totally different approaches to harnessing the torsion field, but they actually may wind up being connected at the fundamental level underneath, you know, the table on which they're sitting. Pun intended.
Right. Well, I would be happy to enter into vigorous dialogue with anyone who's interested to explore these
possibilities. Well, we need to find some really cool mechanical engineers, preferably more than one, because we've got enough electrical people we can call upon. But this needs to be someone who's used to creating mechanical devices of high precision, so when you spin them up at these exotic velocities, they don't explode. They don't fly apart.
Right. Well, getting back to the fundamentals here, you know, going back to Trombley and Tiwari, who were Bruce's principal colleagues in the development of space power generation technologies, which is the term that Tiwari applied.
This is now in the 1980s.
Yes, and their first confab, so to speak, was at the International Tesla Society Symposium in 1988, I believe. Where there's actually some video available.
I know, I think I've got it. Old VHS video of Bruce presenting.
Well, actually, if you go to brucedepalma.com, my associate Mark Ward, who runs that site and worked directly with Bruce all those years ago, has compiled video that largely he shot at the Tesla Society Symposium and in Bruce's labs into a DVD called Why Science, if I'm not mistaken. And you again go to brucedepalma.com. You can order that DVD from Mark Ward, who was Bruce's official videographer for a number of
that
years.
That would be link number 4, brucedepalma.com.
Yes.
On the other side of midnight, Radio with Pictures, link number 4 takes you to where you can actually get this DVD of some of these experiments.
Yeah, and there are other presentations of Bruce's. I think this DVD comes in 2 parts, and there's hours and hours of material.
You realize you need to send me one of these.
Yes, I apologize for not having done so sooner. Simply put, there was a community of interest, if not serious research, that developed around the work of Trombley, Tiwari, and De Palma. In fact, Trombley himself was gagged by the DOD, or the DOE, I can't remember which, because he
It was DOD because they were going to take this as a generator to link to electrical engines in destroyers and submarines.
And in rail guns for Star Wars defense and stuff
and
like that.
And that all got locked up under national security.
Well, the main issue was that Trombley actually had seen some of that work on integrated electric drive, which is homopolar propulsion, if you will, Faraday disc motors.
Funded by the U.S. Navy.
You see, the curious thing for those technophiles out there is that an end machine or a homopolar generator is a non-reciprocal generator. In other words, it does not perform very well as a motor, whereas there is a motor version of the Faraday disc. It's actually what is properly called the Faraday disc motor, where you decouple the magnet and the conducting disc so that the conducting disc is free to rotate in proximity to the pole of a magnet, and you feed current into that disc, and you will get motive forces. At any rate, if you were to combine, here's the question people are probably asking: why was not the homopolar generator developed instead of the induction version, the passage of wires near the pole of a magnet, rather
going back 150 some years?
Yeah, well, it has something to do with the fact that a rotating magnetized conductor, Faraday disc motor or generator, is a low voltage device. Mm. It could produce extraordinary currents. Another reason why it was envisioned for Star Wars is because you could extract 1,000,000 amperes for a split second out of a large homopolar generator. Mm-hmm. Because there's virtually no limit on the amount of current you can pull out. It's like the Earth. The Earth only has 1,000 volts between the pole and the equator. But think of how many millions of amperes are being discharged daily in the form of lightning and other
effects. Do you remember the shuttle experiment with the tethered satellite in 1996?
Of course I do.
Do you think what I think, which is that the astronauts inadvertently discovered the vast end machine properties of the rotating Earth?
Of course I do.
And they fried their tethered satellite with God knows how many 100,000 volts at the point of contact with the shuttle.
You see,
at sunset.
You see, Tesla was relying on similar effects because he wasn't actually broadcasting electricity. Most people think that's the proper way to refer to the Wardenclyffe experiments. He was not broadcasting electricity. What he was doing was polarizing electrostatically the Earth's own electric field and allowing people to tap the generative potential of the Earth itself. He was not pumping electrons through the atmosphere. In fact, he was working solely with electrostatic forces, which are purely potentials. Mm-hmm. He was potentiating through a principle known as...
So he was basically triggering release of electrons at the other end of the Earth from the vacuum, from the field, from the...
Which were already being potentiated by the Earth's own electrostatic field. In other words, all he did was create what's called an elevated capacitance. This is his term, Tesla's term, such that you could stick a wire up in the air like an antenna and achieve a certain voltage from the tip of that to ground.
And see, the neat part about that is if you're not transmitting something,
no,
then there's no degrading
you're
side
right.
effects of biology and environment and EM pollution and all that. Because you're not really going through three-dimensional space. You're going through a higher dimension.
And not only that, there's no back torque, no back EMF on the distortion-creating coil, which was at the top of the Wardenclyffe Tower. There's no matter how many people.
So it really was kind of like the first transporter. Because you're transporting electrons through another dimension to appear in 3D space without going through the intervening space in three dimensions. So there's none of the bad side effects of, you know, standing around a microwave oven or, you know, having too much cell phone activity on your wireless when you hold it up to your ear and it causes cancer. And all those potential problems go away because you basically could have power with a simple system anywhere on the planet just by putting up a wire.
Well, as long as you were within the influence of the distortion. But, you know, Tesla, being the inventor of radio, was very different in his approach to radio than Marconi was. Marconi was probably pumping electrons, but Tesla was not. Tesla was using a totally different form of electricity. This is, you see, there are experts in the field of electrodynamics who will tell you that there's a difference between longitudinal electricity and transverse electricity. And transverse is where you're pumping the electrons, but longitudinal is where you kind of have instantaneous propagation at distance. But the best person to look into on this subject is a man named Eric Dollard, and you'll find his work through the website of Dr. Peter Lindemann, who I can probably get that link for you soon, who was also a student of Bruce's and a good friend and colleague of mine. So, I mean, there are a number of luminaries walking the planet today who have taken this work and furthered it. Tiwari, not least among them, who is actually taking the world by storm right now, as far as I'm concerned, claiming that he's about to market an unconventional induction machine. It isn't a space power generator. It isn't a homopolar generator. But he took the work of people like Eric Lathwaite into the winding of induction machines in a novel fashion and has discovered ways of enhancing efficiency. But the whole point of this notion of free energy, and of course Tesla espoused this himself, is that the energy is always available. It's just how do you use the minimal amount of tickle power to encourage the liberation of that energy? It's just seething everywhere.
Well, one of the stunning things that I found in kind of, you know, bringing his Accutron experiment up to code in the 21st century by marrying a computer and, you know, digitizing the vibration rates, so you can actually look moment to moment in real time with how much it's deviating from 360 hertz, which is what the feedback circuit in the Accutron that Bulova designed is supposed to give you. And what I've got hours and hours and days and weeks and months and years of data. You know, they'd probably stretch around the earth if I put them all together, both in terms of background as well as when Robin and I would take this technology to various sacred sites and sit up on top of pyramids or walk, you know, around Stonehenge or go to places like Avebury and measure the field, the inertial field. And what I discovered, which again, I give appropriate credit to Bruce every opportunity, he conceived of using the off-the-shelf Accutron of a miniature portable inertial change detector. Inertia is not supposed to change. And what happens when you take this little gadget and you wire it up electronically into a computer so you can read digitally the momentary changing frequency of the tuning fork, you find that the tuning fork changes in terms of vibration, sometimes by thousands of hertz. Remember, it's designed for 360. Mm. And it can go up to thousands of cycles above and below that baseline frequency, all dependent upon celestial positions when you're measuring on a pyramid, or whether you're measuring near a pyramid or somewhere out in the valley or, you know, several miles away, because the pyramids appear to be ancient solid-state amplifiers because of the geometry of the materials of which they are composed, i.e. limestone or quartz inclusions in granite. They're solid-state amplifiers of what Bruce called the odd field, that the Russians call the torsion field, that a lot of us have been calling the ether for centuries. It's all the same thing, and it is observable in this incredible digitized version of the Bruce experiment with the rotating disk and the accutron as a variable inertial field that is present all the time, day and night, as the various celestial angles change as we move around the sun and the sun moves around the center of the galaxy.
Well, let's talk about the pragmatics of variable inertia. What can you achieve with it? Well, if you design a machine like a force machine so that it has a ratcheting effect, so that when you push against it, you're turning the inner cylinder containing the two counter-rotating gyroscopes. In other words, you're creating the highest inertial condition possible while pushing. You're twisting while pushing, okay? Then you're able to push against space. But when you pull the machine back to you, it's on a ratchet mechanism, so it doesn't twist when you pull it back to you. Then you push against it again, and you have it twist, and there you achieve your altered inertial condition, i.e. higher inertia, which is basically a force against space.
So it's a rigidly geometrized, if I can coin that term, forced precession.
Yeah.
That is completely controlled through all parts of the cycle.
Which can give you unidirectional thrust.
Yeah. Now, what I think the M drive is, see, if you can imagine, and we should have some animations here, which we don't, so you're going to all have to really concentrate now, everybody listening, and close your eyes. And if you're driving, don't close your eyes, please. Imagine what happens when you take a gyroscope and you make it precess. It forms a spatial cone in space. The electromagnetic M drive is a mechanical copper cone in space. There's a fundamental physics, I think, Andrew, between these two ways of moving against space. One is mechanical and the other is electric, but they're ultimately related underneath in the forces of the ether itself.
Well, I don't want to get too political about science, but one of the things that I think Bruce lamented was how much energy, money, and talent was sequestered by the physics establishment in the pursuit of the defense industries and various forms of high tech that were not necessarily going to advance our basic understanding of physics, but they were, you know, if you're operating under the strictures of thermodynamics, you're basically not going to fund researches that would cause you to have to reformulate those theories unless you're doing it, you know, in a seriously black budget process. So I do believe there are unconventional energy technologies, including railguns, which a man named Peter Greneau, physics researcher, discovered are anomalous from a force perspective. In other words, F equals MA, Newton's fundamental law of motion, does not apply at the instantaneous moment that a railgun is ignited. If you don't know what a railgun is, it's like a Jacob's ladder, which you've seen in all those old horror movies. You know, and it's like zip, zip.
With the electric arc walking its way up between two wires, looking like an old 1950s TV antenna.
Exactly. Well, that is a type of weapon that has been morphed into a type of weapon that does not obey the standard laws of physics, as a man, as I said, named Peter Greneau has shown other types of instantaneous peak power paradoxes, as Adam Trombley calls it, have been found. Like if you discharge a huge amount of current underwater and cause an explosive discharge of that water due to the arc discharge, Peter Greneau also found this generates more force out than in. So free energy has been found in countless individual experiments, but how...
Wait. When you say free energy, you mean energy that shows up in systems, mechanical or electrical, that isn't accounted for by all the equations of what goes in has to come out.
Yeah, over unity, essentially, where you get more out than in.
Mm-hmm. So where's the excess energy coming from?
Well, you know, the idea is that now that our science has reached a point of being able to rationalize a lot of
Andrew, are you still with us? Earth to Andrew. Okay, it says the call got dropped, so let's do this. Let's get rid of that, and we'll try to resume.
Sorry, I dropped
out there.
Oh, there you are.
Okay.
I apologize. I stepped outside real quick. So I would say that the new physics has to simply admit that any anomaly effectively invalidates the entire notion of a one-to-one equivalence between watts in and watts out, 746 watts per horsepower, all of that has to pretty much go out the window, because that only relates to a certain subset of experiments that have been done heretofore. Now that we have a whole encyclopedia of non-conforming experiments, we have to begin to redesign our machines based on a new understanding of hyperdimensional physics. Where the energy is coming from is not important. The fact that it is coming from somewhere is important. And I think the rationalization of all of this knowledge has got to occur in a new scientific forum, or a new scientific priesthood, if you will. Hopefully it isn't a priesthood like the current paradigm is. Maybe it'd be more of an Aquarian.
Well, see, this is where citizen science and the politics of a lot of people independently verifying that which the academy, which the church, the church of science says is not possible.
Right.
And the things that's now possible in this era that Bruce didn't have going for him when he was the revolutionary coming out of MIT and forming those study groups in rural New Jersey on the border between Jersey and Pennsylvania, and then moving further west to Santa Barbara, he didn't have the internet, the ability to harness, like this program is talking to people all over the planet, all over the world. Demonstrably, we've had feedback from Hong Kong and Tokyo and South Africa and the Far East and the Middle East. So we're talking to a whole audience of people that collectively, as human beings on this planet, unless this kind of technology is sprung from the dark recesses of the black ops caves, we don't have much of a future left on this planet. So it's like do or die.
But also, if we're going to be in our integrity, it's like Einstein said, 1,000 experiments cannot prove me right, but one experiment can prove me wrong. So even he was self-effacing to know that there was no way on earth his science was going to stand forever. And any physicist who believes that the laws of thermodynamics are immutable has more or less disqualified themselves, in my mind, as part of the new scientific paradigm, which is to admit – that's what I say about new energy. People go, well, what does new energy mean or new physics? It basically means greater possibility, period. You can actually see a physics discussion that I had with one of my colleagues on Palo Alto Community Television on my YouTube channel. If you browse through my YouTube channel, the link to which is on your page.
OthersideOfMidnight.com, guest page tonight. Tell you what, Andrew, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the last hour. My guest this morning is Andrew Mount. We're discussing the legacy of Dr. Bruce De Palma in restructuring and redefining basic mechanics, rotating systems, processing and rotation, electrical processing systems, electrically rotating systems. There's the basis of a whole Type 2 technology right in front of us, and all we have to do is pay attention. This is from Nick Skouros. It's from STS-80, an album he did many years ago. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
In Houston, while we still have a few minutes at KU, I can just say briefly that we all found very similar results, that the B3 setting corresponding to 5 foot-pounds was certainly acceptable, as was before. But when we get to B5 setting of 15 foot-pounds, that's a fair amount of force to react through your wrist. B6, again, we got low torque.
And we are back on the other side of midnight. Andrew, let's widen the picture here. Bruce did all these amazing experiments, basically revolutionizing mechanics and the relationship between spinning mechanical systems, spinning electrical systems. He built actual practical generators to convert this energy into a usable form. And then at some point in that research career, which was culminating very nicely in Santa Barbara, he picked up and took all his machines and all his stuff in the garage and all the computers and all the gadgets and you, and went to New Zealand on the other side of the planet. Why?
Well, for a number of years, we had run into a situation where, well, first of all, one of his principal backers was basically a conservatorship by his family to stop him from funding Bruce. And that was probably the first insult to, you know, Bruce's sense of propriety. But beyond that, I think we just continued to do one dog and pony show after another for one investor group after another. And we just found that the capital wasn't flowing. And therefore, we felt there was some kind of political or other form of resistance to this materializing in the United States. And we got an offer from environmentalists associated with Greenpeace and also alternative science movements in the Antipodes. And we decided that's an offer we can't refuse. So it was kind of a punt, as they say, down under, where, you know, we decided, all right, well, if we can't make the kind of progress that we think we should here in the United States, why not try greener pastures?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people wanted to read more into it and say Bruce was under death threats or whatever. And in fact, that's not entirely untrue. But in essence, he knew he was reaching – I think he knew he was reaching the end of his life, and he didn't want to mess around. So actually, when we got to the Southern Hemisphere, we were funded like you wouldn't believe. We built 3 machines in the span of 5 years and tested them rigorously, and we had the backing of people up to the cabinet level of the country of New Zealand. Bruce's immigration status was secured by the Minister of Justice at the time, and we were right in with the establishment of New Zealand, and they were awaiting results of our final tests when Bruce passed away. So I actually had to leave rather precipitously the country, and I'm glad this is now a matter of public record, because I was sort of in a gray area of immigration law at that time. They were sort of holding the door open for me. They approved Bruce's immigration status but left mine pending until such time as Bruce could demonstrate and deliver proof of principle to these fairly establishment figures that we were working with, and you know, like leaders of the political establishment in New Zealand were very much waiting on tenterhooks for the results of our final experiments. And then unfortunately things just didn't go particularly well, largely because Bruce was not there for the final tests. He had died weeks earlier. And it was a very difficult time for me. Happened right at my Saturn return. And I was 28 years old, and I couldn't, despite, you know, all the training Bruce had given me, I couldn't carry off a successful test of the most advanced end machine that had been built to date all by myself. So our backers were in a tight spot at the time, because they did have all these people in the establishment waiting for word. And when the initial tests came through inconclusive, they just decided to dismantle the whole project. And I think that was a little bit suspicious, because there were further tests and further improvements of the design that could have been performed.
But well, I've got to ask you this question. The circumstances excuse me, around Bruce's death, were they suspicious?
No. I'll be perfectly frank. Bruce was not in the best of health.
Okay.
Or not. You actually knew a little something about that from years prior, but the issue was partially that we moved to the Southern Hemisphere for Bruce's health. He was tired of beating his head up against the wall, and I mean tired. Bruce was, to say the least, an iconoclast, and it's very hard to live in a society which is, you know, holding on tooth and nail to outmoded ideas and practices when you are already light years ahead of that paradigm. It was just too much for him psychically, emotionally, and even physically. I think he felt it on his very person that he it's that whole thing about inertia, right? He could feel the resistance to change in motion here in the United States. So he decided, screw that noise. I'm going somewhere else where people might actually receive me with open arms. And indeed they did in the Southern Hemisphere. I think there's a more pioneering spirit. There are people willing to take a punt, as they say, down there, a little more abundantly. So we even had the resources of the University of Auckland at our disposal. It was a very exciting time. And there is an image on your site of one of the best machines we built while we were down there, called the Quadrupole generator, which is a fundamental advance in homopolar design.
Which image is that? Number 12?
I'm looking right now. Give me 5 seconds. Okay. Well, there are two of them, actually. They're the two color images.
Oh, 11 and 12.
11 and 12.
Okay.
So what that is a cylindrical end machine where two magnets are housed inside a copper cylinder. They are opposing, meaning the same pole.
North to north and south.
North to north or south to south in the center, with a certain air gap between them. And then the collection of electricity is actually on the surface of the cylinder between the two. If you're looking at the image, number 11, you will see there are two current collectors, as we would call them, or liquid metal brushes that were machined directly into the surface of the cylinder. Okay, and those would ride in a circumferential housing, which you see them resting in. They're made of solid copper.
And okay, so those are those two copper cylinders opposite the center.
Well, that's one whole cylinder. Okay,
but I'm talking about it's divided by a centerpiece that's of a different color than the two copper.
That, that actually is the copper. The centerpiece is the copper, just hasn't been machined like the like the two sides have. That's one solid piece that's had brushes, the current collectors, machined directly into the surface of the copper.
Okay.
And the reason they look silver is because they've been painted with mercury. These were liquid metal brushes to achieve low drag. At any rate, we tested the heck out of that machine. We were able to achieve 6,000 amps at nearly a volt, which is absurd, right? Like 1 volt. What can you do with 1 volt? And as I was trying to say earlier, this is one of the reasons that the homopolar device was not developed in the early days, because you could hardly get anything out of it, because there's an associated voltage drop with the extraction of current, no matter how efficient your brush system is. And if you've only got 3/4 of a volt or a volt to work with, even with super high powered neodymium magnets like we used in this unit, you're going to get half your power lost by the time you get it out of the machine. And again, this is why probably in the future, if we can't develop solid state free energy technologies, we're going to have to use something like superconducting magnets in these new homopolar designs, but we can get into that later. Simply put, the quadrupole generator of Bruce's design was the subject of a patent, the application for which is also on depalma.pair.com, the home of primordial energy, Bruce's website. And the notion is that it multiplies the voltage by a factor of 4 over earlier designs of simple homopolar machines. If you look at the main picture on the home of primordial energy at the top of depalma.pair.com, that is the N1 homopolar generator, which was a 2 times multiplier in terms of the voltage. The voltage is everything in these homopolar systems. And if you can get a significant enough diameter or a significant enough rotational speed or magnetic strength, all of those combine to achieving a decent voltage.
I once told Bruce that the most efficient homopolar generator I'd ever seen was Saturn. You know, on a scale of planets, I mean, look what Saturn is doing. It's got this ring system. It's got incredible voltages across the rings. How do we know that? Because of the so-called spokes, the lightly elevated micron-sized particles of ice, you know, that are floating in the electrostatic fields. When the Voyager spacecraft back in the 1980s went down through the ring plane, something bizarre reached out and basically fried it, and it took days for it to recover electronically and mechanically, and then they couldn't find what had gone wrong. There's a whole description in some of the SPs that NASA published on that mission that are total fabrications in terms of what actually happened, because I was there live that night with a whole bunch of other press people and John Everhart and, you know, people that are no longer with us now that used to work for NPR. And we all saw what happened is not what NASA reported happened that night. So that was our first major example that NASA does not tell the truth.
I think Trombley referenced that discovery as well in his...
Oh, interesting.
Rationalization of why we should be pursuing homopolar designs.
See, that gets into the whole thing, because Bruce started this work in rotation, and all mechanical variants. Would it surprise you, Andrew, to know that we have now identified the De Palma varying inertial signal in several space missions, in NASA and other missions? Starting with, you know, von Braun's classic launch of the first satellite for the U.S. Army, Explorer 1. Go ahead.
It wouldn't surprise me. I'm deeply interested in seeing whether the conventional establishment, even NASA themselves, might not be interested to delve into all this unconventional physics at some point. Would probably take a massive public campaign to petition them, you know, successfully.
Well, but see, if they're not, there's now a huge explosion of private enterprise space entrepreneurship, starting with Musk, Bigelow, The Branson, his up and down. There's the home, DIYers, the do-it-yourselfers who are developing M drives like Dave Disler. There's the EagleWorks crowd, which is developing the NASA version. There is this incipient, imminent explosion of all kinds of democratizable ways to test this stuff up to and including in space. So we no longer have to depend on these agencies whose only reason to exist, it seems to me, is to put the blocks on and keep the sensors in place and keep us from ever getting off the planet.
Well, I liken it to cracking the egg. You know, we are in an embryonic state, humanity is, but not for much longer, because we've reached the bounds of what the biosphere can support in our pursuit of advancement. So we've actually gone so far beyond the limits of the ecology that we may not have much of an ecology within one to two generations if we don't develop some more harmonious way of extracting and utilizing energy.
Well, we have to convert our closed system into what it is in reality, which is an open system. Back to Tesla. The wheel work of nature is how we describe this. A wheel work being a rotating system. So everyone in this field is basically saying the same thing. They talk about different terms. They call it different stuff. But they're all working with the same ether, the same stratum, the same field. And they've created a variety of different technologies to tap into the field. Bruce, I've always said, was the guy who should be first on the runway because he did the science to demonstrate the incredible anomalies, and then he made the leap from the fundamental physics of how do you turn it into a technology which can do something valuable and practical.
Well, the myth of free energy is if we can successfully demonstrate unconventional technologies that finally put to rest the notion that 100% is the limit of efficiency, then people will stop being scared of limitation itself, of lack itself, and therefore the whole competitive mindset and the no free lunch attitude of the, sort of the Protestant work ethic may be revised in favor of something completely new.
I just flashed on this scene because Donald Trump, the guy who's running for president, the entrepreneur.
Barely running for president,
well,
but anyway.
He's running, all right. he is a Presbyterian.
I see.
He's a Protestant. So, yes, if we get around the Protestant worth ethic that you can't get something for nothing, well, you can't in three dimensions, but if you open the door to other dimensions, of course you can exchange energy back and forth, and that's how this has to work.
But the only way that's going to break through the prejudice of our age is through demonstrable examples of the technology, and I do believe it needs to be done in some very public way, whether in the public sphere or the private sphere. It needs to be part of the public discourse that we are now on a truly new cutting edge of science. In fact, if I get off the show without mentioning the work of New Energy Movement and Gene Manning and Joel Garbin's book, Breakthrough Energy, I would be remiss.
That's link number one under Radio with Pictures.
Yes, New Energy Movement is an organization I helped found, and I actually designed and wrote much of the material on the website as well. But the point is this: if this idea becomes nightly news, if this movement becomes the new dream for the society, that we really can throw off the fossil fuel nightmare, that we really can extend our reach beyond, possibly even beyond the solar system, then we don't have to fear even anthropogenic climate change, because there are options. There are new there are new options, not the least of which is to wean ourselves off of fossil fuels a lot faster than solar, wind, tidal, or geothermal, or any of that stuff's going to allow us to do.
Let me give an example of what I think we can do politically, because this audience is very well attuned now to doing things that will make a difference. Mm-hmm. They're funding Distler. They're funding our own EM drive experiments. I want them to think of the challenge of funding continuation of Bruce De Palma's experiments, and I'll give you an example. If we married the most efficient end machine with a Tesla and we drove nonstop across the country, not stopping to charge batteries, not stopping to, you know, go to get hamburgers at Little America, not stopping for tolls, just we kept going and going and going with this huge entourage of television trucks and news media wondering how the hell do they keep going? And we wind up from L.A. to Washington, D.C. in front of the White House, running on an end machine and a Tesla. Do you think that might get someone's attention?
Well, apparently a man named Gerald Schafflander tried to do that with hydrogen and sort of disappeared. I don't know if we're still in the era where people and inventions are actively suppressed.
Well, wait. We happen to have a guy who's very much into cars, new cars, old cars, exotic cars. His name is Jay Leno. He has a CNBC television show. I happen to know Jay. I've got a picture in my files of Jay and me holding a model of the face on Mars many years ago.
Right on.
If I were to take this project to Jay Leno and say, would you like to film the whole thing from coast to sea to shining sea, what do you think Jay would say? No? Boring? Of course not. So don't worry about disappearing. Tell me what we need technologically to create in the way of resources, talent, engineers to do this.
Well, in the last 10 minutes here, or 8 minutes, I'll say that I think it requires some of the most established thinkers in the unconventional science field to come together to ensure that this is not some maverick undertaking that might suffer from the limitations of one person's perspective. I think science is best pursued in a collaborative fashion because everybody's got a piece of the puzzle. Electrodynamic theory is different than electromechanical theory, and you need to find the consonance between all the different disciplines that
but
go
you
into.
See, I'm kind of saying, Andrew, theory be damned. Let's just build something and go do it.
Well, I just don't want to lead anyone to believe that I should be the project manager or set the entire agenda. I would personally bring in about 3 different consultants, including Tiwari. Who is probably one of the foremost experts on the planet. Even Trombley, you know, has unique experience in his own pursuit of these technologies. I would say that what Bruce De Palma was trying to do was couple a Faraday disc motor to an end machine because they are inherently matched because the Faraday disc motor will run directly on the low voltage, but
and I want to know what happens when you process it even a little
bit.
Right.
No, that's right. That's what we need to do. We need to build a force precessed end machine,
and it doesn't have to be big. You know, we're talking a few $1,000s. I mean, that's what Dave is spending to upgrade his technology by a factor of 100 based on the support of this audience. So
I can tell you, nobody has done that. So if that's where we want to go with this,
that's where we want to go.
A force precessed end machine would do it. And it's actually in the paper at depalma.pair.com. Again, that's link number 7 on othersideofmidnight.com guest page for me tonight. You look at the home of primordial energy. Let's see where that paper is. But at any rate, it's probably under the secret of the force machine. Down at the bottom of that, or nearly at the bottom of that, there's a figure 2, I believe, and it's counter-rotating flywheels. If those were magnetized flywheels, that is the device. Figure 2.
Anyway, I think we can build this and it won't cost an arm and a leg. Let me include Torch. He has an interesting question. Torch, what do you want to ask Andrew? Hello?
I don't hear the caller.
I don't hear him either. Okay, so.
Maybe they can type it on.
They can't unless they're connected, so try connecting again. In the meantime, we've got about 3 minutes left, 2 minutes now. Until your next appearance, where do you want to leave us? You're involved in a bunch of other stuff that kind of took second nature to Bruce's historic work tonight, but we will have you back to talk about that.
The principal reason I started working on permaculture and soil and building my local food system where I live is because I am an ultimately pragmatic person, and I didn't want to wait for the free energy revolution to get off the ground before actually making some strides in some area. And also, I felt like I was somewhat ungrounded trying to, you know, be a lone maverick or even a maverick in collaboration with others, because this whole field is dependent upon the evolutionary state of humankind as a whole. We need to up level big time if we're going to bring free energy to the masses. That means this community and a lot of other communities are going to have to hold tight together in the face of all sorts of criticism and all sorts of pressure. I'm ready to throw in my 2 cents and my personal energy to this. And in fact, I recently stated on my Facebook page that I am rededicating myself after years and years of being out of the loop to free energy, because I'm very concerned about the state of the planet. And I've always felt that an energy paradigm shift was, you know, pivotally necessary.
Well, I'll tell you what, in the last couple of minutes we get here, get me some specs, let me know roughly what we can do in the way of an engineered machine shop device that will prove what Bruce was demonstrating decades ago, and then we move on from there. I think this audience will support you. I think it's important that this be done as a demo, and I think it's another part of the citizen science democratization that goes around the filters, it goes around the agencies that apparently don't have our best interests at heart even now.
Open source physics, huh?
Yep. Okay, we're at the end of the show. I want to thank my guest this morning, Andrew Mount, who was executive assistant to Dr. Bruce DePalma. We've gone extensively into Dr. DePalma's work this morning because basically if what Bruce discovered is correct, everything we think we know in the form of mechanics is not correct. So until tomorrow morning, same time, same channel, my name is Richard C. Hoagland. You've been on the other side of midnight as we rotate from dusk to dawn. And until tomorrow morning, just remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.